Well, hello and welcome to what is a special edition of the Adoption and Fostering Podcast with me, Al Coates, and him,
Scott Caston Rennie.
Well done. And we also have, yes, I know, well done. It's very early, isn't it, Scott? So you're feeling
it's
a bit bleary.
Way too early for me. Way too early.
Yeah. But we've also got with us Krish Kandaya, who is the sitting chair of the Adoption and Fostering Leadership Board. No, that isn't it. It's the Adoption Special Guardian Leadership
Board. No, it's
not. Board. Sorry.
For goodness sake.
Oh, yeah.
Take two.
I had one job. No, I'm just going to stick with it. People, I'm happy for people to think that I'm an idiot.
I get it wrong all the time.
That's fair enough. Well, hello, Krish, anyway. Sorry.
Morning.
How are you?
Good to see you guys. Yeah, really well. Really well. The sun is shining.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much for coming on, because if you recall, it was probably the first week in January last year that you came on and you were kind of literally hours into your new role. So you said you'd come back and you very kindly have. So start at the beginning, really. How has the year been?
Oh, it's funny, isn't it? I think partly because of lockdown, all my last 2 years seem to have merged into one. So I can't remember what's happened in 2020 or 2021. But it's been an exciting adventure on the board. I came to chair the board having never even visited a board meeting before. So maybe that was a good thing. I kind of didn't know what I was going to get myself into. I guess the overall experience for me is adoption is a lovely, well, adoption and special guardianship is a lovely place to work. So many of the people involved in it have a real passion to make a difference for vulnerable children, whether that's someone like Kathy at the Family Rights Group or Kevin Woods, one of the lead DfE participants in the board. So we have a lot of good people wanting to make a difference, and that's been great. I hadn't quite realised the degree of spaghetti bureaucracy there is within adoption and how many different parts of the puzzle, how many different groups and interests there are. And that takes some while to navigate. But, yeah, I remember talking to the Adoption Reference Group, which is a fantastic group of adopters who provide their experiences, and you very kindly, Al, have been helping us kind of pull that together and representing them on the board. And a lot of them have been saying the same things for a while, and I share some of their frustrations that change is relatively slow in adoption. Yeah. And partly that's because of how many moving pieces there are. So it's been quite an experience.
Was it because I was conscious that you had obviously you were given the role with your own sort of agenda, with items that you were going to bring to the agenda that weren't necessarily there historically, so, or weren't as prominent historically. So have you felt that you've been able to kind of raise the profile of some of those issues?
I think so. And some issues that really weren't on my agenda before, we've also managed to raise the profile. So we're called the Adoption and Special Guardianship Leadership Board, and I'm a great one for equality. And it does feel, has felt for a long time, that adoption was the kind of star player and special guardianship was the kind of neglected middle child, if you like. And I've really tried to work hard to kind of, oh my goodness, I'm going to quote a government phrase, level up. I know. Too much time with the department. Level up the exposure and I guess the focus on special guardianship. So we now have, to match the adopters reference group, we have the special guardians reference group, and that's been fabulous. And having a rep on the board from there has been great. And I guess we'll get into talking about some of the priority areas for the task groups in a bit, but we've put a lot of attention into special guardianship. And I'm really pleased, for example, the care reviews got a lot of focus on that too. For me, it's all about the children. What's going to give children the best chances of a genuine, permanent family arrangement? And if they can't go and live back with birth parents, then kinship care, special guardianship is so fantastic for so many children. And it's only for those that can't find kinship care or through special guardianship that we're really looking for adopters in my book. So really seen a big uplift in the way that special guardianship's been given a lot of focus.
Right.
So with all that, I mean, you're on socials like we are. You read things, yeah. You see things. There's lots been said over the last 12 months. And one of the big things early on, and it's continued on, is the adoptee representation, how that might fit. And I mean, is that something that you're working towards, working on?
Yeah, definitely. I'm really keen to have the voice of the child represented, and not just the voice of the current children, but the voices of those who were children when they were adopted into the process. I've been working very closely with Sarah Jahal, who I think is, fantastic, doing a great job as the leader of the REA group, that there hasn't been a clear group that had both kind of those with relatively recent experience of adoption and those with historic experience of adoption, and recognizing you want to put the right kind of pastoral care around those young people if they are going to be young, and talking about some of the difficult experiences and traumatic experiences they've had. So we're basically working on a group together, because there's a lot of duplication in adoption, I'm finding, a lot of groups within groups within groups. So if we can combine together and have one really well-resourced group of adoptees, that's our plan. So we've got one in embryo that's kind of forming, and it's, I think we've had one, or I think maybe just trying to work out the terms of reference, how it's going to work with them coming onto the board. Don't think it's appropriate for kind of one young person to be there on their own. Kind of want to give them some backup. So maybe give them a bit of training so they have some confidence about raising their views and their voice in this setting. So it's closer now than it's ever been. I need to touch base again with Sarah and find out when it is we'll be able to actually have our first person in place, but we're taking our time so we do it well, I think.
And I guess that pastoral thing is quite important, isn't it? Because if you're going to mix a group of adults and young people, then it's kind of there's a lot of risks involved in that, isn't it?
I find that with it's same with some of the other reference groups. So if you have adopted a long time ago, your experiences are different, but often, not always, but often the people that want to contribute to these kind of groups have had something really terrible happen, and that's driving their kind of desire to make a difference. And that's really positive, but that's one experience of adoption. And you put someone who's relatively new to adoption, and you need that fresh experience because the systems are changing all the time. And they might be a little bit more optimistic about it. You put those in the same group and you could get some interesting dynamics. So again, it's really important. One of the things I said when I came to chair the board is it's too big. I mean, there's 30 plus people that come to a board meeting. We've got, 2.5 hours, 3 hours, if we're lucky, together. It's too big to make tactical strategic decisions. But on the other hand, it's too small. There's not enough representation. We've got, I think, one definitely LGBT member. We've got only a handful of black and ethnic minority members. We haven't got an adoptee voice. I really want the parallel for the special guardian. I don't even think we've got a proper word for it, but those who have grown up in a special guardianship placement, I want their voice on there too. I'd love there to be more from the kind of legal world because they have such a huge influence on the way decisions are made. So it needs to get bigger and smaller at the same time. So the way I've kind of gone for that is make it bigger through representation and then smaller through task groups who really do, I'm trying to avoid the word deep dive, really give a lot of focus to some really big issues that we can kind of drill into and try and make some change. So that's my tactic. And it's, I think to a degree it's working. We've seen some good traction on a number of the issues, but it's taking some time to kind of restructure that.
Can I ask, in the middle of the year, we obviously got the new adoption strategy 2021. I ask how involved you were with sort of the formation of that strategy?
Yeah, it's an interesting one in that I'm an independent chair. So, I'm appointed by the Secretary of State for Education, but I'm appointed by them to be an external voice. And, you know, the DfE are one player within the kind of board. So we've got, you know, family rights group and kinship and adoptors all there. So it's an interesting one. I've noticed it, I guess, with the children's commissioner role. There's different ways you can play a role like that. So Anne Longfield, I'm a big fan of. I thought she, you know, raised a whole bunch of issues, but she definitely seemed to be working, I guess, a bit outside the tent, and you know, really good at holding to account and challenging, but wasn't necessarily that involved in design of strategy and program, as far as I could see. And Rachel D'Souza, you know, seems to be at the moment working the other side and also trying to hold to account. It's an interesting dance, you know. So I guess with my role, it's similar. It makes sense to work as closely with government as you can, because they've got the ability to make decisions and changes. So I had some involvement, but in the end, it's a government document that they've set the priority for. And they don't ask my permission for what goes out there. You know, they're in control, but I can influence and make suggestions.
Because it seemed, obviously, there was the introduction of Sarah Jahal's role, which is the head of the RAAs, or the RAA lead. And that is interesting, because you talk there about system and you talk there about raising issues. And in some ways that Sarah Jahal's been given that role really on a systemic level to lead the RAAs, which is practice and policy. Yes. So just, which it kind of maybe you bought into one job and then sort of paired it off a little bit. So does that mean that your job, you can be more focused on those kind of those bigger issues, the, where is the option going to be in 10 years? How do we look at these more rather than practice stuff?
I'm a big fan of Sarah's. You know, I think the work she was doing locally was absolutely fantastic. It's often her neck of the woods, which is used as a model in lots of different areas, like things like matching special guardian payments to foster care payments. That was rolled out in her district. So there's lots of really good experience that she's got, and she's an innovative thinker, which is brilliant. So I see myself working very closely with her. And if in one level, you know, adoption is really crowded, there's lots of players, but if at the kind of national level, there's more hands on deck, we can work a bit more effectively together. I am really interested in what adoption is going to look like in 10 years. That's a big conversation that I'm, I suppose we're at the kind of middle stages of discussing, well, what are some of the interventions that might need to happen now to make adoption appropriate, fit for purpose, you know, child-centered as we move forward in the next 10 years. So I'm really fascinated by that. And I think now that I've kind of understood a little bit about how the landscape lies a year in, that is where my attention is going. What does 10 years and beyond look like?
So looking forward then, tougher question now. Any news on the Adoption Support Fund that you can tell us about?
Well, interestingly, that you've probably heard it from government, and my reading is this, that the Adoption Support Fund is something the government's very proud of. I hosted a transatlantic summit between the UK, well, England, because it's a devolved issue, adoption, and the US. And one of the things we were proudest of and telling our American colleagues and counterparts about was how great our Adoption Support Fund is. And the incredible feedback people gave, particularly during lockdown, where it became a lot more agile and was able to kind of help on a wider range of issues, that seems to be positive. So I've not heard honestly, I've not heard anything that says the government's support for the Adoption Support Fund is going to decrease. I've not heard anything like that. What I do hear often, and you've probably heard it too, is that when it comes to budgets, and this is a whole new world to me, even the schools don't know they're definitely going to get their money next year. There's, you know, every time the budget comes around, they have to kind of rework it up. So at that level, we don't know what's happening, you know, in 3 years' time. But for me, as far as I've ever seen, there is a commitment to go forward, because I realised just how much it matters to adopters and special guardians of previously looked after children that they get the support they need. So, yeah, that's all I know. It's probably what you know too. And I think that's as good as we're going to get, sadly.
Yeah, I mean, when I think about when it was first rolled out, or when it was first trialled, you know, there was talk of having it funded by other kind of areas outside of the government and stuff like that. But that seems to have kind of stalled. And I think it's this kind of jolt from year to year, knowing if it's there. And it's not just for the families, actually. It's for the people who provide the services as well, isn't it? Because, you know, they have to kind of ramp their things up, applications, having the therapists and on board, etc. So it's not, you know, I guess it's one of those kind of debates you could have about a child's life. You know, doesn't work to financial years. You know, it's but sadly, governments and businesses do tend to work like that. So it's a bit of a
yeah, it is frustrating. I mean, again, as I'm looking at it, and I've not had much conversation about that, keeping the funding inside seems to guarantee its future better than looking for it outside. But yeah, I mean, I'd love your, I guess, take on it. So, you know, the Adoption Support Fund, our experience, my, you know, taking my chair hat off and my experience as an adopter, even for someone that's relatively good at navigating systems, it is quite complicated to access. And so our experience is it's taken a long time to be able to try to get anywhere near funding for our own daughter. And, you know, that concerns me, and it's one of the things we keep raising to make sure that the fund actually is accessible by people that need it. The other thing that I find really difficult is, again, it's the name. I thought I'd be able to change the name. That's proved more complicated than I thought. So special guardians of previously looked after children can access the Adoption Support Fund. But, and this is something, again, it's a bigger project, and I'm sometimes it feels like pushing water uphill. If by an accident of how your child came into the care of your, the child's grandparents or aunties and uncles, they weren't ever looked after, then that child, even though they're coming from exactly the same circumstances and they're basically living in the same circumstances as another child who was previously looked after, is now with the special grant, they can access nothing from the Adoption Support Fund. And I find that really hard. For me, it ought to be about the child. How do we build a system that works for every child, not just children that by accident of their, you know, where they were born or who their aunties and uncles are, have access to different routes of care. Surely every child that has the same needs needs to get the same support. That is my overarching frustration. And lots of people feel it. It's just, how do we do it? And particularly in a time where, you know, every government department is struggling for budget because of COVID and where our economy's at. So, yeah, that's a real struggle for me in the Adoption Support Fund.
It seems interesting, isn't it, that what seem like small changes that have real sort of token, seem to have real significance, can often be real sticking points. Like you said, the Adoption Support Fund, if it was the Adoption Special Guardianship Support Fund or some version of words that reflected that, that's a real win. It feels like a real win, but it actually becomes incredibly complicated and time-consuming. And so some ways, you know, on Twitter, we can all agree that that's what we should do, but it's not that easy. Can I ask you then, because I'm conscious that you have got limited time with us, can I ask you about the task groups and the specific work around that? Because I think that's, it's easy to look across a year and kind of go, well, you've had however many meetings and you've had lots of conversations. What is tangibly being done? But can you tell me about the work of the task groups, you know, in relation to, I know we had a recruitment one, a support one, a racial disparity one. Tell me what you're proud of. What's been going well?
Yeah, well, again, really excited to be working with some fantastic people. And there are four task groups. So one of them is the Special Guardian Task Group, and that's headed up by Lucy Peake from Kinship, formerly known as Grandparents Plus. I think Kinship's a fantastic rebrand for them because it really captures who they're supporting. And I'm really excited about that, because as we polled, you know, the sector and Special Guardians and spoke to the Special Guardian Reference Group, a whole bunch of issues came up. And I guess one of the biggest ones is around poverty, that a lot of Special Guardians didn't plan to be looking after children in this phase of their life, maybe their grandparents, maybe their aunties and uncles. And some people have, I've met some aunties that had to kind of give up their career to take on their nephews and nieces. And they don't get like adoption leave like we would get as adopters. They don't get maternity or paternity. So for some of them, there was that beginning time they had to kind of give up their work, which is, you know, really tough. But also in terms of the allowances,
I mean, I feel like you're telling us stuff that we know. Sorry to be so blunt. I'm conscious of time. I've got so many questions from people. But have you seen Tangent? Right, okay, right. I am going to step up and be a bit more Radio 4.
Okay. Yes, Radio 4.
Yeah. Like all Paxman on you. But what have you seen any, would you say this, you've seen any changes or developments in relation to how the Special Guardians have been treated or the services provided to them?
Yeah, so the two things that I think we can point to, and again, system change takes a while. So we're trying to help local authorities get a vision that matching foster care payments to Special Guardians is better for children, better for the guardians,
yeah,
and also cheaper for the local authority. So it's a triple win. And we're basically highlighting best practice and then encouraging local authorities to do that. So we're at the early days. We only just had, just before Christmas, we had a big roundtable on that. We've got a report coming out in the next month or so. And that's our aim. We use that push to change the way that Special Guardians are treated. And you've probably seen within the care review, Special Guardianship is really high on the agenda. And I think the whole mood music is that feeling of being an unloved middle child as Special Guardianship, as a care intervention, is changing. So I'm proud of that. I'll try and go a bit quicker. Racial disparity, that was another big area. It's a passion of mine. We've had, you know, two number 10 roundtables to kind of move the needle on that. We have a report that should come out in the next, well, I don't know the timeline. That's not in my gift. But some pretty bold plans in that. Like one of them, for example, and that's already getting some traction, is that when I went forward for adoption as a brown person adopting a mixed race child, I was quizzed rightly about the child's cultural identity and heritage, but every single member of the panel was white. And you go, well, you know, it's a bit rich, isn't it? You know, in terms of talking about looking after my child's cultural identity, we've got a very monocultural panel. What could we do to change that? And I maybe you've already met Ade, who's brilliant and has already been commissioned to help change that. So even ahead of the report coming out, this conversation that we've been having is making tangible change, as RAs at least and VAs are on the way too, are trying to get to the point as a beginning that when it comes to black or mixed race adopters or black or mixed race adoptees, there should never be an all white panel. I mean, one day it would be great if there was never an all white panel, that we had good diversity there, but that's our stepping stone. And so that's been quite exciting that we're beginning to see some tangible change to practice, I guess.
Well, that seems quite obvious, does it not? I mean, like, yeah, I've been sitting on panels for 12 years as someone from the LGBT community, and the majority of them have got, you know, different ethnicities on them as well. I mean, you would have thought by now, in 2022, that this would be a thing, you know? You think it'd be really obvious. I mean, for me, that's quite unbelievable, actually, so, yeah.
But that's interesting if you say that best practices, you cannot make any sort of form of meaningful decision without representation on the panel. Just like that's something that every local authority should kind of just step up and get their finger together. I mean, that will be difficult for some local authorities. I mean, I think about, you know, a place like Northumberland, Cornwall, where a tiny minority of that community is
things are more online now, especially with panels, aren't they? So that might be a little bit easier.
Yeah.
So if you're in a monocultural area, again, our ambition is modest to begin with. When you've got black or mixed race adopters or black or mixed race children, that's when you need to bring it into action. Mm. And then the flying panel members can kind of help you with that. But you're right, it isn't rocket science, but it hasn't been done. So let's get it done.
So what else about the risk disparity group? I'm part of that just as a transracial adopter, so I know a little bit of what's going on.
Yeah, I mean, some of the interesting kind of feedback we're getting from different, I guess, members of the sector, it feels like in some areas, frontline social work is pretty diverse, but the higher that you go up the kind of management tree, the less diverse it becomes. And you know, it matters to all of us and to a healthy society that is diverse. It particularly matters when you're trying to rebuild trust with communities that might find social care challenging. And again, you can see from kind of wider studies that particularly black communities, there's a breakdown of trust. Even the government's own race report mentioned that breakdown of trust with the criminal justice system and with healthcare. I don't think they asked the question about social care, but my gut tells me that trust is also challenging. So we need to diversify the leadership and management of the children's social care. But what I'm being told is adoption in particular is pretty white. So even at the frontline social work, let alone the managerial level, and, you know, the REA leaders themselves mentioned there isn't an obvious, you know, maybe someone has heritage, but there isn't an obviously black or mixed race lead to the REA. So again, that's something that we want to change. And again, change takes time. You're trying to change culture and not just kind of place people in situations where they're not going to be supported. So that's also an area that we're really pushing hard for some change in.
But I think the fact that you know the group has been put in place beginning of last year, that you've already started to highlight things. I mean, there's a whole lot more that has been looked at, but that it feels like it's a really positive development from my perspective. And
that's
like all of these things.
Good to hear it. I mean, again, change takes time. We're trying to pick the things that we think will have the most amount of impact. You know, everyone on those task groups are volunteers trying to struggle with lots of busy programs, but people have been really generous with their time and people seem to really care about this. So, yeah, we had a fantastic transatlantic summit, again, looking at black adoption experiences. And to me, the highlight of that was hearing from young black adoptees, particularly those that have been adopted transracially, who were talking lovingly about their adoptive parents, but also recognizing that because most of their parents were white and most of them were black, their parents hadn't been able to equip them for how to deal with racism. So what is it that needs to be in place to support transracial adopters? So that, you know, looking back historically even, how do we give them the support they need to be able to better stand alongside their children in a still racially divided world? So that's something that we're really passionate about. And it looks like there's some kind of good movement about to happen in that space as well.
I think the interesting thing I found about that, not to get bogged down in this group, but I think that it was the idea that often transracial adopters, no one sets off to be a transracial adopter. That often it comes out of necessity. And so potentially their assessment isn't focused on that really significant specific issue. It's a matching people go, oh, would you take this kid? And they then do a small piece of work, not necessarily the comprehensive piece of work that needs to be done. But it's all on the agenda now, isn't it? It feels.
Yeah, I think that's right. And yeah, I hear from a lot of social workers, they're keen for better support to be able to do that well. So watch this space. I'm quite encouraged there could be some good movement there. Just to wrap up the other ones, so I chair the Racial Disparity Task Group. There's Sue Armstrong Brown that chairs the Support Task Group, which cuts across both adoption and special guardianship. And, you know, changing the names is part of the challenge, but we're still kind of plugging away at it. What we heard from adopters and special guardians is probably the most influential impact on their child's well-being, apart from their family, is school. And that's where we found a need for I suppose, innovation. What's it going to look like for schools to become attachment and trauma informed, so that every contact anyone within the school has with a looked after child or a previously looked after child is through that lens of being, you know, child-centered, trauma-informed. So we had some really good traction this year. This area is controversial, I found out, within schools, not necessarily from the teacher's perspective, but sometimes, and you know, it's a new schools minister now. I haven't met the new schools one, but the previous one, this wasn't a priority for him, let me say. So what we've done is we ran a big event. I think 3,500 people came to it, called Every Child Flourishing. It heard from Care Experience Young People, it heard from Sir John Timpson, it heard from the Anna Freud Centre, Betsy Detiri, a whole bunch of really helpful input, and it's still available online. I'll send you a link if it's helpful to your listeners. Thank you. And it was aimed at teachers and SENCOs and parents, so that together we can learn the impact of what a trauma-informed approach might take. And off the back of that, I've got good reach to particularly faith communities. The Church of England Schools Network started a learning community that's going to run for a year, and 200 schools are on that journey. So each month they meet and think about what systems change would look like for becoming trauma and attachment informed. My vision is every school needs to be trauma and attachment informed. Right. And I thought I'd do a little bit like they do in the playground. You know, if one child's got a Rubik's Cube, pretty soon everybody wants one. Well, that was my childhood in the 80s. so if one set of schools, 200 schools, have got a trauma and attachment kind of vision, could we make that go viral in the best way within the wider schools network? So it's going to be benchmarked and externally reviewed so that we can see the impact it's having. But I'm quite excited about that.
I mean, schools are like, it's an issue. If you light the blue paper and adopters go off about the challenges of schools. So I'm not going to be drawn into that because I think we could talk.
Well, that generally does take over in most meetings that I attend, so yeah.
Okay. Let's see if we can make it better.
Yeah, we'll try.
So just moving on to some of the questions that we've had from social media people. So Kat Teresa, who is a regular contributor to a lot of stuff, as an adopted adult, I guess, she's thinking more about adoptees therapy and kind of some of the logistics and the kind of requirements about that. Is that something that you're thinking about for the future right now, or is it kind of something that's on a list way down there in terms of adoptees being able to access it as adults? Because right now it's Ofsted regulated, isn't it? So
yeah, to be honest, again, in order to set the priorities for what the board could do in the limited time that we do have together, we polled widely. I think you guys shared some of the survey out, which was great. And that one didn't come high up the agenda. I mean, I am interested in adopted adults and the access that they have to, ongoing support. But I guess probably the focus for me at the moment is the current cohort of children that aren't getting adopted, and those that are in adopted placements with, could we give the more early support we can give them? I'm really interested in maintaining family relationships and what that looks like. That's a whole big area. But I think there's some preventative work that we could do that would make life better down the long run. Thanks for raising it, and I'll keep kicking the tires on it as I'm in other meetings and see if there's energy out there.
Well, I think it's an issue that's gaining traction, really, because the reality is that my children are adults now, and so that they can go to a therapist and they can say, oh, I want to talk to you about my anxiety. This is not my children, I'm not sharing hypothetically. They could go to a therapist and I want to talk about anxiety, depression, early adversity. Fine. Any therapist or practitioner can help. The minute they say, I think it's adoption related, they have to be Ofsted registered. And I understand the kind of safeguarding of people who go to seek support and therapy. But the reality is, I think it's just turned into a barrier for a lot of people. The minute a therapist knows, goes, sorry, can't help. And that feels like a really big injustice. You know, when we think about, because, yeah, there's maybe, what is there, there's something like 60,000 children who are adopted at the moment, but there's hundreds of thousands of adults who can't or struggle to access therapy.
Mm. Let me take it away and see what the current thinking is on that. It's not currently central on my radar, that, to be fair.
That's absolutely. I mean, you'd make a lot of friends if you could change it. You'd be, yeah. You'd be put back on people's Christmas card lists.
It's not even a thing, Christmas cards anymore.
Yeah, good point. Those e-cards are pretty rubbish, aren't they?
Just
be, like, even be, them.
Be like me, don't send them. Anything. Scott, have you got a question, or do you want me to go for the next question?
No, you go.
Right, excellent. Right, one thing I've seen sort of started to raise quite recently on social media, and I'm not sure how big it is a thing, but there's a recent petition in relation to self-employed rights, adoption leave rights. And it's a mess anyway for self-employed people. But I saw that there was a petition, and the petition's reached the threshold for a government response. What are your thoughts on the fact that prospective adopters can't, if they're self-employed, can't get access to maternity or adoption pay?
I don't know much about the detail, but on the surface, again, that does seem like an injustice, similar to the special guardians not having any access to that. So, you know, it shouldn't be, again, that the accident of the circumstances of the family that you're being adopted into means that you don't get the same level of support as a child, and having, particularly in those early stages, you know, really good time to build those relationships does seem really vital. Yeah, let me take that one away too. I've not come across that.
Yeah, I don't think it's a massive, I don't think it impacts an awful lot of people, but it just seems like a really easy win to kind of go, all right, we'll just move you into that column with all the other self-employed people. But because it's not adoption. So that's something that I think the government will have to give a response to, because that's reached the 10,000 threshold on the petitions.
Wow.
Doodah.
Yeah.
I know all the technical terms. You mentioned
contact. I think as well, you say the word technical, Al. I think that some of the wording around some of that leave as well is quite precarious, isn't it, in terms of understanding it. And also employers as well. It does cross over the employers one, not just self-employed, because some employers pick up wrong as well. So it'll be interesting. We'll keep an eye on that one, see where it goes.
Excellent. Put on your to-do list. Thank you, Krish. I was going to ask you, you mentioned a little bit about contact, and I guess that really is lifelong links. What's been your kind of learning over the year in relation to that? Because I think it's an issue that is just, it's a bit like education. The minute you sort of fire it up, people run with it, because it's significantly involved in, people are very invested in it. And I think the thing that I think is that the legislation we all sit under was written before Facebook was even thought of.
Yes.
Or Twitter, Twitch, Snap, Face, Chat, whatever yeah. Scott tries to get in touch with me through. Because Scott's down with the kids, aren't you, Scott?
No, really not. Really not. Really
Insta, Snap, Face, Chat.
So you're right. I mean, in this last year, there's been some quite high profile cases of inappropriate, unsupervised contact between birth families and adopted children. There was a big case on Radio 4, wasn't there, that kind of carried on for quite a while. And I'm really sympathetic with that. As you say, you know, the digital age makes all sorts of things, you know, possible that weren't in people's minds when legislation was in place. And you know, digital security for looked after children is a huge issue. Kids, again, in my experience, children that have had a looked after background are often more vulnerable to cyber stalking and phishing scams, because there's often a desire to, you know, be validated and affirmed and loved. So that's a huge, huge challenge, of which, you know, inappropriate unsupervised contact from birth family is a subsection. I mean, the other side of it is the Rees Centre, I'm forgetting which of the team, is just publishing a report on a study in New South Wales, where those children that were adopted, and you know that in Australia, adoption's relatively rare, but foster parents who adopted their foster children maintained contact with birth parents under some pretty extreme circumstances. You know, even if there was abuse, neglect, sexual violence, there was still contact under very strict circumstances, but there was still contact. And at the beginning of that study, I think everyone was a bit uncertain about whether that would be helpful. Some were quite opposed to it. But at the end of the study, I think the majority of adoptees, adoptors and birth parents had thought that had been helpful. Now, for me, this is all about the best interests of the child. If it's in a child's best interest for there to be continued helpful contact with birth family, I want it. You know, and I want to flex the system around what's going to best serve the children. Now, I know many adopters are going to find that quite challenging, but not all. So there might be a journey we need to go on to make that possible.
Do you think then
seem to be part of the legal conversation around the future of adoption too?
Yeah, because we've got a place like New Zealand where there's a presumption of contact. And would you think that if we start to invest more money into that and more resources and we develop social work training, so that actually, you know, one of the things I was asking a question about something else, but people are saying social workers have got no training around sort of reconciliation, about mediation in specific this stuff. Is that something that you would like to see a push towards more resources being put into?
Well, it's an area I really want to explore. We're going to have a board meeting in February and we're going to put a proposal forward around what the next task group's going to be, because one's come to its natural end and we're ready for a kind of new one to begin. It's the one around matching, because the REAs have a matching task group, so we don't need to duplicate. I'm keen that we kind of streamline down. But what does, you know, the helpful maintenance of family links look like is one area that we're considering looking at in that task group. But I want the board to have the chance to kind of debate it and see how they feel about it. I think, you know, contact's a funny word. I find the naming of it quite difficult. Our local authority has now called it family time, which I find really problematic, because what's happening in our adopted family? Keeping in touch. I'm not sure that's right. And it needs to make sense to children. There's a whole bunch of questions I have around that. But contact as it currently stands, even as a foster parent, I have problems with it. It feels like, mandatory time in a room with both parents and child. And no one's necessarily asking, how is that time best used? Mm. I'd love to see some therapeutic intervention there. What about some family life history work? You know, at the moment, I've sat in this room where you've got an adult who doesn't necessarily know what to do with this child, and the child not really knowing what to do with this adult, and they're not given a lot of support or help. And I think that's not good for anybody. So, again, money's in short supply, it seems, within the sector, but it does seem there might be a case for better support earlier, particularly in those early days of the child being separated from birth families, and then those kind of transitional years as teenagers when identity becomes important.
It feels like the system is just not wired up for it. It just feels like it's wired up for sending letters once a year. And my experience of this over the last sort of 18 months, we have contact because we had exactly that same experience of being foster carers, so we maintained links.
Yeah.
Amazing. But then the last few years we've tried to re-establish links, and literally I've had to write contracts for my local authority and say, they're saying we don't have a contract for like between set parties. And I said, well, I'll write you one. And you're kind of going, but this is your day job. So it feels like you are literally pushing water up a hill because they just don't know how to manage it if it's not a letter once a year to grandma.
But it's Scott, hard. And again, just as long as, for me, the needs of the child have got to be central. As a foster parent, there are some contact sessions where it's so disrupted and dysregulated the child in my care. It's been, you know, weeks, maybe a month before they're back to normal again. And so that didn't seem in the child's best interest. It might be long-term, but short-term, it definitely didn't feel like it. So again, what training do I have as a carer, as the adult in this children's lives in order to give the child the best support they need in that. And again, the social workers, as you mentioned. So it's a big area. We're at the very beginnings. We're just, again, finding the boundaries and the most useful thing that the ASGLB could do in that. And we're going to have a debate and see if it's something that we want to proceed with.
We're moving into the quickfire round now. So, Scott,
yeah, we are.
You,
yeah.
like 7 minutes. Colgate or Aquafresh? Is it those kind of questions?
So obviously we know regional adoption agencies. How is that going? Obviously, like you say, Sarah Joel, who's also been on the podcast quite a few times, she's very good at what she does, has been appointed as kind of the leader of the RAs. I think that's the right phrase, can't remember. But how is it going generally? And are all local authorities now in regional adoption agencies? Is that done?
I think we're close. I can't remember if there's one left or that other one has joined in. It is looking positive in that there is consistency. I've been around adoption a little while, and at the beginning there was a lot of fear and challenge about them. I think it is the way going forward. And I mean, with Sarah's appointment, there does seem to be a really good chance of practice improving, because you're not just got a regional adoption agency, you've got a national network, so best practice can be shared. There seems to be a lot of room for innovation. I'm quite optimistic. I'm also a big fan of the voluntary adoption agencies, who do fantastic work and you know, help find adopters for children that have been waiting a long time, and some of their support services are excellent, and you know, it's part of my history in the area, and finding the way that can work best, the RAAs, VAAs can work efficiently together. That's really important to me. But also, so is this kind of national picture, that the regional matters. But, you know, that there's been a few cases where particularly people of colour have approached their regional agency or their local agency trying to adopt, you know, within their racial heritage, and have been told, sorry, there's no one here for you. But if we were thinking nationally, there really is. How do we make sure that children are getting the best chance of, you know, a successful, flourishing adoptive family? And I think some of that has a regional aspect, but some of it has a national aspect too. And maybe with Sarah in post, we can get the best of both.
Mm. I was just going to say,
he's running the clock down. Keep him on track here. He is running the clock down, I can tell.
The impact of the agencies, are we going to see any kind of report on that, or, you know, is there going to be any kind of review of it?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that, well, again, my memory's foggy still. It's January.
Well, there was one, wasn't there?
There was one, yeah.
Yeah, I'm thinking about, like, in the future, you know, once they're kind of all part of one, to see.
Okay. You know, I imagine. I mean, it feels like there is a government interest in reporting on impact. It wouldn't surprise me if there was a follow-up report, as you say, now that everyone's in. But I don't know how long it's been since the last one and when the next one might be.
I think it's a couple of years anyway, isn't it? I think.
Excellent. Maybe. So here we go. Next question. What was your first album you bought?
I think it was Now 2 or something terrible.
Oh, right. That shows your age. Pam Hodgkins, that's... who cannot be messed with, and we must, if I don't ask this question,
you must.
She said, you promised you would promote the need for intermediary services to be available to everyone at the CVA conference in October. An update on that would be great, but you've got 1 minute for an update.
I promised that intermediary services. Man, that's a good memory. I don't remember that. Can you tell me what's she talking about? What does she mean?
Pam was the founder of NORCAP, wasn't she? And she's been dabbling back into the scenes after retirement. So she's really hot on kind of intermediate.
For accessing people's files, isn't it? And supporting people in who are historically getting their files back and then going into reunion.
Okay.
So I think it's those intermediary services.
She's done well to remind me if I said that. So I need to go and check how that's going, because I've completely forgotten I'd said that. That's terrible. It's not what she wants to hear.
She's coming after you now.
She's in a pitchfork.
So you've got, have you got any more specific questions, Scott? Because I've got one last sort of, what does the future hold question? And then Trish has to go.
I'm just looking through all the questions and no.
And so what's your priority for 2022?
So the priorities are all based around the task groups. So, you know, let's get Special Guardians the allowances they need. Let's ramp up support, particularly in schools. Racial disparity, we're going to have a big report that comes out, and hopefully we'll move the needle. As is always the case, we won't get everything we ever dreamt of, but if we can get some substantial change, I'm happy. And my fourth task group, I'm hoping it has around maintaining family links in a way that I think will ensure children that haven't previously been available for adoption will be made available for adoption, because we reform adoption so it's fit for purpose, so that children that otherwise wouldn't get a family that they can say is, you know, permanently theirs beyond 18 actually get access to one. That's really important to me.
Oh, well, I think, yeah, that task group around that, it seems like a really significant issue for a lot of families who just constantly in touch with us, aren't they, Scott, about links and stuff. Well, Chris, thank you so much for your time. I know you've got another meeting to do. Do you need a selfie? Because I know that, like, if a tree falls in the forest, does anyone hear it make a sound? If Chris goes to a meeting and there's no selfie, did it happen?
All right, he's smiling. I got you. Very good. Great. Well, hopefully it'll promote your podcast as well, so everyone's a winner.
Absolutely. And the podcast will be out at the end of this week on Saturday. So thank you so much for your time, and I wish you well across the year.
Yeah. I hope you get better, Scott. Sounds like you got that leg in.
Yeah. Well, we'll see you in 12 months.
Yeah. Will you come back on?
Oh, you know me. I find it hard to turn invitations down. So yeah. It'll be good to see you again.
Excellent. All right. Cheers.
It's for work, so.
Okay. Yeah.
Bye. Bye-bye.